Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. I have some jumper cables in my car. Do you have some in yours? I've used mine a few times, especially mostly at work in the parking lot. I'll come out after work and somebody will have their hood up. I'll run over and jump their car and get the battery going. Maybe you've done that as well, or maybe you don't even have jumper cables or know how to use them. Well, Jim Ward's going to help us out with that today. He's the service manager at Smart Motors in Madison, at over 10 years of master certification, working professionally with vehicles since 1978. He comes by every so often to talk with us about vehicle maintenance. We'll zero in a little bit on jumper cables and also how to start a hybrid. That might be a little, well, I'm sure it is a little different. Anyway, he's here to answer your questions. So give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. And Jim Ward, great to have you back.
Well, thanks, Larry. It's good to be here. Found my way in through the fog this morning.
Yeah, it's got a little foggy around this morning. People are a little hesitant to use jumper cables sometimes, I think, and maybe with some good reason.
Well, there are some concerns, although, you know, when we talk about jump-starting cars, just about any set of jumper cables will usually do the job. It usually is pretty straightforward, and it usually goes just fine. Nobody gets hurt, nothing gets damaged, the car gets started, everybody's on their way, life is good. But we certainly do see situations where damage can occur. The systems are very unforgiving. So if you touch that cable to the wrong place, it's instantaneous. You don't really get a moment. And as much as you would think that the fuses in the car would probably protect any circuits, that's not really true. Fuses are tripped by amperage, and voltage can be much higher on a spike and go through and damage computers. So that's kind of the concern, is probably if something goes wrong, that's probably the most common thing that goes wrong, is that either a computer gets shorted out or some of the fuses in cars are not just a cheap little fuse either.
Yeah.
One of some of the main fuses that protect your electrical system are like a big breaker that can actually be pretty expensive, like $150 to replace.
Ooh.
So, and that can be the light end of things. But as I said, most of the time that isn't what happens. The other concern is physical injury, and that's why handling the jumper cables and just how you do it is pretty critical. One of the most common concerns about personal injury, it has to do with ignitable fumes, gases that might be under the hood of a vehicle, particularly over a battery, over a charging battery. The most conventional batteries have got a acid inside of them, and that is going to outgas, particularly as you start to charge that battery. So again, that rarely happens, but it does happen. In almost 40 years of doing this, I've only personally ever seen one battery explode, rarely do those things go wrong. One of the first questions, because it is something that if you don't have to do, you probably don't want to do. So one of the first questions you want to ask yourself is whether the car isn't starting, is it really the battery? Is a jump start going to help? If you turn the key and it cranks over, in other words, you hear rah, 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 and it's turning pretty fast like that, it's probably not the battery, because that's the starter turning over, and that's what the battery in most cars does. Although hybrids are a completely different, different category and different animals.
But if they go click, 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 click?
If you go click, 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 that's a pretty good indication that it probably is your battery. One of the things you can try yourself is just try flipping the headlights on and cranking it over. If the headlights dim right out, that's a pretty good indication that either the battery is low on charge or we've got a connection problem. So if you've established that it doesn't crank over fast, and that the headlights dim or you hear that click, 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 then we're probably at the point where we justify opening the hood and let's take a look and see if I know where the battery is and what if I can identify the positive and the negatives on it. Sounds simple enough, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, it's just amazing.
You don't want to be putting the positive on the negative.
You don't. And it's the thing is, it is awfully easy to do. It's awfully easy to do. Even very experienced tow operators that'll go out occasionally will make a mistake. Of course, you know, they're probably doing it. When that happens, it's probably in the dark beside interstate with traffic flying by, and you'd be a little nervous and could do something like that. Anybody could. But so when it comes to the jumper cables themselves, there's lots of different qualities out there. Generally, you're going to be advised to get a 6-gauge wire. The lower the gauge on wire, the thicker the wire is. And 6-gauge wire is with the insulation over it is going to be pretty big around. You know, it's probably big around as one of my fingers, and I've got pretty big hands. Can't see that on the radio, but you know, you're talking about probably almost 3/4 of an inch to an inch in diameter of those cables. The thinner the cable, the less power can get through it, and the less efficiency you have for that jump start. Another thing people look at with jumper cables is that you can buy jumper cables of varying lengths, and it seems very logical that sometimes you've got a car that is in a parking stall and you can't get to that side of the car, so it seems like a 15, 20-foot jumper cable would just be the ideal thing. But again, that requires a great deal more power to get through that long set of jumper cables. So just some considerations. There's a whole new generation of jumper cables that have surge protectors on them because it's possible during a number of steps in a jump start procedure for there to be a voltage spike. And a voltage spike will get right past the fuses in the car because they're designed to trip at amperage. And so if that spike goes past the fuses, you can have computers fail. There's certain models that we see certain characteristic things happen. There's certain models that we see if it's jump started wrong and you touch wrong, the blower motor is going to burn out. Heater and air conditioner blower motor, as odd as that sounds, that is where that voltage goes on that model every time. Certain models, it'll be the radio, and other models, it'll be like the body electric computer or one of the other computers. And some modern vehicles, most modern vehicles since about 2000, have a staggering number of what we call control modules, but they're really little computers, sometimes up to 3 or 4 dozen of separate ones in the cars. It can be complicated. Again, I got to emphasize that this is done over and over every day. The vast majority of times it goes just fine, but you do have to be mindful about what you're doing. So that being said, if you pick out the right jumper cables, and the modern generation of them have surge protectors, but then you have to read the instructions carefully, it is a good idea to look at your owner's manual. There are some cars out there that they don't recommend jump starting at all. There are a few models that the manufacturer just says, just don't do it. Usually there's going to be a real high-end line like a Jaguar or Mercedes S-Class. They're just so sensitive. They're not going to recommend you do that yourself. A safer way to do this and probably something that can give you more peace of mind and give you more security is to have a jumper pack. And jump packs have been around for a long time. There are a couple of two or three really different kinds of jump packs. There are really small little ones that'll just give a quick charge. If the situation is that you left your headlights on overnight and it just quickly discharged the battery, one of those would probably get a car going. Then there's a larger jump pack with they're a bit heavier, they're larger, they'll often have a head or a flashlight on them, maybe a tire inflator. These have a larger battery that holds a greater charge. So if you've got a car that hasn't been run for a month and the battery's just dead, that type of jump pack is probably more appropriate because you can connect it to the battery and just leave it for a few minutes. It's going to actually transfer charge into that battery, even though it isn't a battery charger. It's going to transfer charge into that battery. But the quick little jump starters are probably not going to do it for that car that has sat for a month without being run. And now the third generation that's out is that there are lithium batteries are lightweight, a lot of power, and that's the latest generation. I was doing a little research just to see what's out there now. I saw one advertised for a diesel, 20,000 milliamp hours power, which is plenty enough to start a diesel engine. They have various cables that you can charge your phone and all kinds of other devices, and they can be charged from your car from a 120 outlet. The key, of course, with any of these devices is that you need to have them plugged in and charged all the way up. Some of the better ones have a charge a pilot, a little light you can push. You can look at either a set of lights or a meter to show the level of charge so that you can monitor it over time. You could theoretically charge one of these up, and it might hold a charge for several months. But it's nice to be able to check and see if it's still got the charge, you know, to take it back in the house or plug it back into the lighter and charge it up. So those are best because with that jump pack, you don't need somebody else's help. You don't need the other car. Jumper cables are great, but if you're the only one out there, get done cross-country skiing and you get back to the parking lot, nobody's around, those jumper cables aren't going to do you a lot of good.
Well, Phil in Hebron, Illinois has a question related to this. Let's go there. Hi, Phil.
Morning, Phil.
Are you there? Let's see. Well, let's
start. Like Fred Flintstone mobiles, and I'm driving one right now that's 18 years old.
Okay. Oh, we lost him. Oh, nuts. Call back, Phil. I'm sorry we lost you.
I want to hear about that Flintstone mobile.
Yeah, I want to hear about it, too. I'm sorry we lost you there, but we'll just call back and we'll get you back. We have more callers on there. What about while we're setting that up? What about hybrids?
Well, hybrids do have a 12-volt battery. The 12-volt battery in a hybrid doesn't generally serve the same purpose as it does in a conventional car, in that it doesn't power the starter. It powers computers that allow the hybrid computer to actually start up the car. But those without the power to those computers, it's not going to start. One of the probably most significant things to know about a hybrid is that 12-volt battery is a much smaller capacity battery than a conventional car has. So hybrids generally do not make good vehicles to jumpstart another car from. It's a little more awkward on many hybrids to get at the battery. But it's a different type of battery generally. Many hybrids will have a battery in the passenger compartment. That's a different type of gel in that battery.
Are they 12 volt?
They are 12 volt systems. And yeah, when it comes to jumpstarting, by the way, you never want to mix voltages. If it's 6 volt to 12, 12 to 24, not okay. You need to stay with the same voltage system on a given car. But
we've got Phil back, so let's...
There he is.
Yeah, there's Phil. Hi, Phil. Thanks for calling.
I'm back, gentlemen. I drive Honda cars until they look like Fred Flintstone mobiles, and I'm driving one right now. It's 18 years old. I've changed out the original factory battery once in that 18 years. Car's never been garage kept a day. My question for you is, how much power on a 28 below night sitting on my driveway is that battery losing?
Most of it. Typically a car like that's probably going to have the factory recommended battery replacement would probably be in the range of 500 to 600 cold cranking amps. And ultimately, on a nice, summer day, you need less than 100 to start the car. But that's the whole point of having the 500 or 600, is that as it gets cold, there are a number of things that happen. Primarily, the cold will just rob any electrical system of that power. That battery is going to lose probably, 75% of its power sitting there. And there are a number of other factors, of course. At that temperature, the oil is much thicker, so the mechanical turning of the engine is much harder to do for the battery and the starter. So it's going to have lost most of it.
My dad was a long-term diesel mechanic for the Burlington Northern. He always told me, you will learn with time, keep the car out of the wind. It's the difference between the car starting and not starting on a cold night. Do you buy that?
Theoretically, that isn't true. But I'll tell you what, I don't know very many people who have a 99 car, and that's about what I'm guessing that Honda is, that have had a battery last as long as yours lasted. So I'm gonna go with that evidence that there might be something to that.
There we go. Thanks, Phil, for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Kate in Madison next. Hi, Kate.
Hi. I have a couple questions on oil changes.
Yeah.
It used to be that you had to get an oil change every 3,000 miles, but now they're telling me like every 5,000 or 6,000. And also, is it much better to get synthetic oil? I have a Toyota Corolla now.
Yeah.
Well, you want to use the oil that the manufacturer recommends. And for a Toyota, depending on the year, yours is probably conventional oil. Just going back a few years, about 2009, 2010, Toyota started converting all of the vehicles over to synthetic oil, and now almost everything is synthetic oil with much longer intervals. The intervals with synthetic oil are 10,000 miles or 1 year. So your car, I don't know what year it is, but it's likely to be conventional oil in there, and ultimately that is going to be a 5,000-mile or 6-month interval, whichever comes first. And that's engines, both engine oil has been developed and refined and improved to the point where it is a much better product than it was back when we can remember we did every 2,500 or 3,000 miles. And the engine manufacturing technology has come a long way. So the surfaces that that oil is protecting are actually much tougher than they used to be and not as likely to have a problem. The biggest concern I have with the long oil change intervals is that engines will still use oil. And you don't see very many stations anymore where you pull up to the pump and somebody comes out and says, check your oil.
Yeah.
You're old as me if you remember anybody even doing that. So, you know, and so modern cars will burn some oil and it will be necessary for people to start learning to check that oil somewhere, you know, between that 5,000 and 10,000 mile change interval.
Yeah. Thanks, Kate, for calling. Appreciate it. And Ann in Appleton, we'll get to you next. Hi, Ann.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Okay, here's my question. I drive a Saab that I don't drive over the winter, and I keep a battery stabilizer on it. Before I did that, I would just periodically start it up, but then I had to have my battery charged, so I took it to the store that I purchased the battery from, and I had a feeling they didn't want to replace the battery, but they said that, oh, you have a parasitic drain or something to that effect. And I just wanted to find out, now I have the battery stabilizer that I keep on my car. Do power surges affect my battery? And also, can you elaborate on this thing they call the parasitic drain?
Well, there's always a drain on the battery, even when you're not driving the car. I mean, just to the car, modern cars have a number of computers. They need a certain amount of power to maintain their memory and everything. Your little digital clock's got to keep its memory. Most modern cars have self-tests that they do. Not an uncommon thing to have somebody call us and say, you know, I walked out into the garage about 4 or 5 hours after I shut my car off, and I think my fuel pump's running. I hear this, and it's actually a vacuum pump testing one of the evaporative systems. They're designed to do that, and of course it takes power to do that, and you're not running the car at that point. So even when you're not using the car, it's going to use power from the battery, and if the car does sit, it is a good idea to get what's generally called a battery tender, and it's a smart charger. They're a pretty small device. They can be connected right to the battery kind of permanently so that you have a charge plug that comes out in the grill in the front of the car. And these are designed to know when the battery, to sense the battery state of charge, to know when it is low on charge and to charge it only then and to shut off once the charge gets off. Because that would be the concern if the charger you have on it is just continuously charging, that can eventually damage the battery. It's not so much a concern about voltage surges as that once the battery is charged, if you continue to apply charge to it, you start to kind of evaporate away the electrolyte inside that battery. So, but most, I'm pretty confident that if it was a battery store that you got the battery charger from, it probably is a smart battery charger, a battery tender, and they've been around for many, many years. Or you know, any marina that stores boats over the winter, they use those in the boats. It's a common device, and they're very safe. It's a very good idea if your car sits quite a bit. It's a good idea if you have a lawnmower that's going to sit in the garage all winter, and you know, you're not going to charge that battery. But not a bad thing at all.
All right. Thanks, Ann. Appreciate the call. Jim Ward, our guest today. Once again, he's service manager at Smart Motors. Over 10 years of master certification. Great to have him with us. Cheryl Gasser, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. Right now, we're taking a look at your vehicle and its maintenance with Jim Ward, service manager at Smart Motors. You can join in. We have open lines get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. Ellen in Superior emailed us and asks, with colder temperatures, do you really need to let your car warm up before driving it? Will it damage the car if you don't wait? If so, what damage is done?
Well, and generally, you don't have to warm up a car, although colder temperatures is a relative term. We live in Wisconsin, and you know we might call colder temperatures 10 degrees cooler than today, but when we're really talking about cold temperatures, 20 to 40 below, any car is going to be it's going to be advisable to warm up any car just for a few minutes at least. Modern cars, cars made since about the year 2000, the engineers really do not design them to need to be warmed up. Their intention, in fact, the emission systems are designed to actually reach their peak efficiency the quickest by driving the car and getting in, getting it going. And but it, you know, there anyone who has lived in Wisconsin very long and gone through a 20 below or colder temps knows that if you start the car up, it's going to groan and make some noises. You're not likely to damage anything in those situations, although occasionally things can be frozen together and damage can occur. It's another one of those situations where that rarely, rarely happens. But, you know, I'm inclined, if it's that cold out, I'm inclined to let the car run for 60 seconds, a couple of minutes. It really isn't necessary to run any longer than that.
They always seem to run kind of stiff if you start up and get go right away on those really cold days.
Yep, you might get some belt squeal if you turn the wheel. If you got, you know, yeah. Most modern cars will have electronic power steering, so that's even something you probably wouldn't hear. But
can happen. Tim in Columbus, thank you for calling.
Hi, I have a 2003 Nissan Sentra, about 200,000 miles, that I have to start every day when I need to start it. With a hairdryer.
I love these stories. Tell me more.
My camshaft position sensor started throwing toads, and the car would buck and chug and not run right at all, if it ran at all. And once the car warms up, then it's fine. So I found that if I heat up the camshaft position sensor with a hairdryer for about 10, 15 minutes before I start the car, that plug has warmed up to the point where it will behave itself. And away I can go.
Brilliant.
How did you come on the hairdryer idea?
Well, I realized that it just wouldn't run right when it was cold, but it would run right. It would start up every time when it was above freezing.
Great deductive logic.
So, and I knew that it was that part. I had replaced the plug with one from Junkyard because, of course, they don't buy that plug is $400.
Yeah. So there you go. So
Someone that knew I was coming on the show today told me another story about jump starting their car with, it's not exactly jump starting we're talking about here, but jump starting their car with their charger drill battery, which I'm not going to recommend doing that. And you know, you found a workaround. I mean, there's that sensor. Likely, did you say you did replace the sensor with a used one?
I've replaced the sensor with a new one, but replaced the cable end, the plug, with a used one, because the cable plug is a cost prohibitive part.
And it, you know, I mean, the reason that this may still be going on, there's a number of possibilities. It may be something as simple as the actual terminals on the connector. This has probably been on and off a number of times because you put the used one in, you know, a different one, and somebody else diagnosed it. They've taken this on and off of there, and I mean, there's no way to know for certain without tightening it up. But basically, with electrical connectors, you have a spade type of connector with another piece that slides over it. If that has a looser fit than it should, they can not make contact. Heating it up may very well allow it to make a better contact than it was making before. So, you know, at the very easiest hopeful solution to this, I would take a look at trying to find a way to tighten up the contacts for the part that slides over the top, and see if you can't do that. Sometimes even twisting the terminal a little bit, the flat spade terminal, but you want to be real careful with that. Those connectors can be pretty touchy, and an older car like that, you know, you don't want to break that and have to look at doing a wire harness repair.
Yeah.
Older car. It's still got at least another 400,000 miles left on it.
I don't consider older to be a bad thing. I'm right in that category myself. So
there you go. Well, keep your hair dryer handy, Tim, and in the meantime, check the tightness of that fit. Al in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Al.
Hi, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
2003 Suburban, 200,000 miles. I am told this may have been the first year of the fly-by-wire system for the throttle.
Mm-hmm.
My problem is the infamous P1516 code, which all my internet research tells me that this truck is, and the Silverado family are famous for. So when it throws the P1516, it puts the truck into a reduced power mode, and yep. I used to have to pull the side of the road, turn the truck off, restart it. Well, I've gotten so good with my handheld scanner that I can actually reset the code going down the highway.
Sure.
But I'm sure you have a better plan.
Well, there is likely a bulletin for that. And ultimately, I can't say I'm intimately familiar with bulletins from a Suburban of that age, but typically they're going to have had a software reflash to make the computer read differently, I believe, is what the solution for that particular problem was. But I would usually, I mean, used to be you had to go to a dealer to find service bulletins. But that's not, you can usually Google for a bulletin like that and find, unfortunately, doing the software reflash, depending on the age and year of the vehicle, sometimes that's just a software download. Sometimes that can mean having to replace a module, which, you know, the software download is not something you're going to have access to be able to do yourself. You can't really just like download it from the internet, but that is likely where that's going to go.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Al. Cindy in Middleton, your turn. Hi, Cindy.
Hi there. I have a 2010 Scion. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I have a 2010 Toyota Scion. Long story short, the batteries had to been, I had to get a jump many times, but I think it's an excellent battery for that very reason. And I don't want to have to replace it. But is it possible just to get it recharged, or I'm not sure I'm saying the right thing, but...
Well, no, that's a great question, because what batteries for the car continually discharge and get charged back up. If they discharge too far, we tend to call that a dead battery. But that's kind of a misnomer, because when most people say dead battery, they mean a discharged battery, whereas we would think if you say a dead battery, you mean it's not coming back. That's the end. Goodbye. So, but actually, a dead battery usually just means discharge, can be charged back up and recovered. There are testers that can tell us whether that battery is going to be okay or not, and that's what needs to be done. If the battery is okay, but it's had, if it's discharged a lot, there may be a number of reasons for that. Either the car isn't being driven enough, or we may have connection problems. If you look at the battery terminals that connect the battery to the car's wiring harness, if you see a lot of that blue-green corrosion on those terminals, that can simply interfere with enough of the power from the charging system, from the alternator or generator, getting to that battery and actually being able to charge it up. So there are a lot of possibilities besides a bad battery, but the battery can be tested as a quick, easy test, and it is generally definitive. Every now and then, a battery will be so discharged, it'll say, charge it and retest it. But most of the time, a simple test is going to tell you whether that battery really needs to be replaced or whether you have another issue going on.
There we go.
Great. And you're with Smart Toyota, is that right?
Right.
I love that place. It's been so good to me. So thank you so much.
Yep. Absolutely.
Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate it. Joe in Washburn has something for us next. Hi, Joe.
Hi, I know you addressed the issue about warming up cars in cold weather. Well, up here on Lake Superior, you know, there's, and all over the state, and especially in the Midwest, you know, people have these remote starts. And there's been a conflicting discussion on MSN, you know, related to remote starts, people starting their car, leaving them run, so the car actually probably, so the interior warms up more than anything else. And the issue of premature engine wear due to, gasoline, the rich gasoline on startup for a prolonged period of time, washing down the cylinder walls and creating a problem with premature engine wear.
Mm-hmm.
And so the engineers have been tossing this back and forth in the comment section, and I just wonder what your take is on these, remote starts and people letting their car sit there and warm up for 15 minutes before they start driving them.
I'm not really a fan of remote starts, just for a number of concerns about someone being present in the car when it's running. That's just my personal take on it. That doesn't mean remote starts aren't very convenient. Man, you get a real kind of cold up there in Superior. So if I live there rather than down here in sunny, balmy Madison, I might have to think twice about that myself. The key, though, the of your question about fuel dilution, we don't see the kind of fuel dilution on cars anywhere near what we used to see years ago. When I started working on cars, it was at a Volkswagen dealer, and of course, dealing with air-cooled cars. Sometimes somebody would come in for an oil change and have an extra quart of quantity in the oil, which was just gas, and you could smell it. I mean, you could burn that stuff. We on any kind of cars, no matter how people warm them up with or without remote starts, we don't see anywhere near that kind of gas dilution anymore. And I, you know, it may. And the other factor is that modern cars tend to warm up much quicker and tend to cut that fuel mixture back. The fuel management systems are so dialed in that fuel dilution into the oil like that, just unless something's malfunctioning, that really isn't a huge concern. It's a marginal concern. I have far greater concerns about people checking their oil on synthetic oil vehicles that are going to go 10,000 miles or a year, in that second half of the year, in that second 5,000 miles, and I worry about, you know, engine damage from these kind of things.
Yeah. I've got a great story about starting a vehicle. And this goes back several years. A friend of mine and I were going into Madison on a very cold night. We were on a rural road, and we were driving slowly because it was slippery. And a caterpillar with a blade on it, went across the road right in front of us. We stopped the car. And it went slowly down in the ditch, and nobody was on it, went over a fence. And so we stopped the car, and I was driving. My friend jumped out and jumped on the vehicle, on the caterpillar, and stopped it. And then we went into the house where it had the driveway. And the person had started it up, and it was so cold, didn't realize it was in gear. And once it warmed up enough, it took, it just started on its own.
Man, that wasn't going to stop on its own for a long time. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, well, and
we'd have been about 3 seconds quicker.
And there are a lot of safety systems with remote starts. I mean, most of them are set up so that when the door will remain locked, and when you come to the car, you're likely going to have to unlock the door, and most of those systems are going to shut the car off, and you have to restart it at that point is how most of them work. Again, convenience is a great thing. A motor vehicle, there's potential for so many things to go wrong that it just makes me nervous for that action to be taking place, for it to be starting. I mean, that somebody's cat wandered into your garage the night before and you start. Of course, did your garage door open, if you left it in the garage to warm up? There's just a lot of things that can go wrong there.
Let's go to Tom and Nelson next. Tom, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yes. Hello. Good morning. I have a 99 Volkswagen Passat that I love, and it drives just fine. Anyway, a couple summers ago, I pull into the gas station, fill up with gas, car doesn't start. Hopefully, get my jumper cables out, beg some people, we can start with the jumper cables, no problem. Nope. Won't start. I end up pushing it over in the corner and parking it there. So the next day I come back and I go over and visit my buddy at the body shop. Anyway, and he says, well, I've got these heavy-duty jumper cables. Let's try those. And sure enough, started right up. So my question is, what's the minimum gauge of battery cable you would recommend?
Gauge 6.
I had a smaller gauge one. He brings these heavy gauge ones over and started.
Gauge six. I mean, gauge 2 wires are just huge, and you can get them custom made. Sometimes at a parts store, cheaper than you could buy regular ones for. But that does make all the difference. You've got to have enough big enough pipeline to deliver enough juice to get it going. And although we're not talking about liquid juice, it's kind of an equivalent thing. It's got to have enough capacity to deliver the power.
And the lower the number, the higher the
more power you got. It's counterintuitive that the smaller gauge is a bigger wire.
So you'd recommend what?
Six
gauge is the standard recommendation for jumper cables, but there's plenty of them out there you can buy that are lesser than that. And again, the majority of the time that'll work just fine. But when you really need it, you want all the power to get there.
Yeah, I know. And I was just I could not figure out what was wrong, and it was like, man,
get gauge 6, Tom.
I got to check. I bought a new pair. I got to see what it is. I forgot what it was.
Okay.
Thanks, Mel.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Oh, boy. Antonio in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi.
Hello, gentlemen. I have 1958 Corvette with 26,000 miles on a small block Chevy 283 V8. Last summer, I was taking a long trip. All of a sudden, it started blowing oil through the breather. I tried conventional wisdom and tried to put vacuum and PCV valve and what have you. Nothing really stopped it. I was wondering what's causing this oil blow through the breather.
And this seemed to have started up very suddenly, just a instantaneous change.
I noticed it last summer. That was the first time I noticed it. It was running perfectly well prior to that.
Well, you want to start out least invasive here. And your logic was correct to check that PCV valve. The next place you want to go is under the valve cover. There's kind of a vent guide system for where that PCV valve's going to draw from, and you can get varnish and sludge buildup in there that will block the flow before the PCV valve. So although the valve itself may not have been the problem, it somewhere in that system it's likely that is blocked. I mean, for that to be blowing through there that way, especially if it happened real suddenly, I got a feeling a chunk of something came loose somewhere else in the engine, some sludge, and is blocking a passage somewhere on the inside of the engine side, on the inside of the valve cover for that.
Mm.
But that's your best hope, because from there things get quite a bit more expensive and quite a bit more invasive into your engine. But that's where I'm going to start.
All right.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. By the way, we have open lines. Get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Kevin in Washburn up next. Hi, Kevin.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
My question was, when you are jump-starting a vehicle and you have the vehicle running the one that you're jumping with, when revving up the engine, does that help... help increase, you know, with the jump start, like putting up the amps?
It can, but it's not recommended that that's where you start. If you look at a jump starting guide, that is a guide for jump starting one car from another. Again, when it comes to safety for both the people doing it and for the equipment, the safest thing is not to have another car at all, but to have a jump pack. And the safest thing you can do if you have two cars is actually the safest thing, and this is not what necessarily is going to be recommended, would be to take the battery completely out of the donor vehicle and disconnect the cables to it. But again, that's generally, I wouldn't go that far personally. The first attempt should be made just connecting the cables with neither car, obviously the donor car not running, the other car doesn't run, and leaving them connected for a few minutes. So there is a transfer that will occur without either car running, just with the cables connected, and that the vehicle with the discharge battery is going to get some charge from that. That may be sufficient, and in most cases that will be sufficient to start the car. If that doesn't work, then it's recommended that you start the donor car. Generally, it is, you don't necessarily want to rev it. Revving it would increase the amount of power, but just the act, like when you start it, there can be a voltage surge. So you want to be real careful how you do this. I might disconnect that last negative cable before I start that donor car, and then very carefully reconnect it, because the startup process itself is where a lot of times there's a voltage surge. So the preferred answer is that car is not running. But if that doesn't work and it doesn't supply enough power, then the next step would be to start that other car. But again, when you do that, you allow a number of other opportunities for damage to occur, another number of opportunities for voltage spikes.
There we go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jim Ward, service manager at Smart Motors, our guest today, talking vehicle maintenance with him here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. Taking a look at your vehicle today with Jim Ward, service manager at Smart Motors in Madison. Lots of experience. He's been working professionally with vehicles since 1978, so it's great to have him along. And we'll go right back to the phones and to Vivian in Green Bay, who has a question. Vivian, hi. Thank you for calling. Vivian, are you there? For some reason, we don't have Vivian. Well, let's try John and Poinette.
That's me.
Yeah, hi, John. Thanks for calling.
Okay, thank you. My question is regarding a 1979 MGB that I bought about a year and a half ago during the summer. And the turn signals worked fine, and then after a while, they didn't work. The person I bought the car from included a new flasher unit, because he'd had that problem a few times. And so I installed that, And what it seems to do is, if it's cold out, like less than 60 degrees, the turn signals don't flash until the car's warmed up. If it's 80 degrees out, they work right away. The four ways, the flasher unit seems, for the four ways seems to work okay. And I thought maybe it has something to do with the engine being warm. But I drove the car about a month ago when we had a warm day, and I think it was probably about 45 degrees or so, and they worked right away. So I'm dumbfounded.
And John, you're saying that with the four-way flashers will work when the car is cold?
Yes.
Okay, so what that tells us is that the wiring, that the bulbs and the sockets, the wiring to all of those, the flasher relay themselves are all fine because that's all functioning right there. The turn mm-hmm. signal switch, the lever that you flip to run your signals, somewhere between that turn signal switch, possibly in that switch, or the wiring between there and the flasher relay is where the problem is. And it's very likely to be in the switch itself.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. We had someone call in or sent an email who has a 2002 Pontiac Aztec. Its gas gauge has been all over the place for about a year, and so it doesn't read the level of gas properly. Does that mean the pump will go bad, or can I still continue to drive the vehicle and just reset the odometer back to zero when I fill the gas tank?
The fuel gauge float and pickup and system is in the same little module with the fuel pump. Does not necessarily mean the fuel pump is going to have a problem, although you can have a relationship there with the ground. But if that were the case, the fuel pump problem likely would have come up right away when you're only having the fuel gauge reading problem. And it isn't necessarily the float in the tank. The fuel gauge reading wrong could be up in the gauge itself. Diagnostic equipment that you can connect to it would allow you to use the diagnostic equipment to act as the float, and you can tell it what positions the gauge should read, and if the gauge doesn't follow, then the gauge is the problem, and vice versa. You can test the other way and use the meter on a test unit as the gauge and see if the signal is accurate from the float back in the tank. Very occasionally you can have ground problems, but this probably isn't a ground problem. It is likely to be that unit in the tank, but again, some testing needs to be done to determine it. Doing the math, if you can fill the tank, don't how many gallons you put in and monitor your mileage, but mileage changes at different times of year and different driving conditions, so you want to be kind of conservative and leave yourself some leeway and room if you're going to do it by the math method to make sure that you know how many gallons you have, how many miles you can drive. But I would probably take however many gallons you put in there and subtract at least one, if not closer to 2 gallons off of that when I do the math. So calculating to empty so that if I err, I err in my favor and I can maybe still drive another 25 miles.
What's the idea behind some people say, well, you ought to keep your tank full or, rather than let it run all the way down, and it's kind of better you get condensation, yeah. I've heard.
Condensation is the primary concern with that, is that if the tank is full, there's not a lot of room for condensation. In Wisconsin, most people are running ethanol in their cars. Ethanol is alcohol. It absorbs water and condensation. We don't see anywhere likely kind of moisture, water, and condensation problems with fuel systems that we used to because of that ethanol in the fuel. Mm-hmm. So there isn't as much of that kind of concern. But, some of it is just basic safety sense, is that, if you end up, on a rural road somewhere, yeah, or if you're on a trip and you slide off the road or can't proceed anymore, if the engine will still run, you have a source of heat there. And you have twice as much time with that heat if you have a full tank of fuel than if you have a half a tank. So it's just another consideration of why to do it. In fact, that's probably my greater reason than the condensation, really.
Yeah. Ann in Milwaukee, thanks for calling. Hello.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to just tell a cautionary tale about the impact to one's battery when you leave your key in the lock for an extended period of time. Uh-huh. I left my car in the driveway for a body shop to pick up and do work on it. And while I was gone for several, this is while I was gone for several weeks, and I had given the shop my keys in advance, And a friend checking on my house noticed that the car was back in my driveway with the keys in the outside door lock in the driveway. She removed the keys and brought them inside. And when I returned home a week or so later, the car wouldn't start. A neighbor jumped it, and I ran a bunch of errands without a problem. And then the next day, I drove to my dealership to get the battery tested at their recommendation. And 10 minutes after I arrived at the dealership, they came back to me saying that they couldn't start my car and that the battery was toast. And I ended up getting the body shop to pay for replacing the ruined battery because the dealership said that when you leave your keys in the lock or in the ignition, the car assumes that it's going to be started soon and that there are several systems, pre-start systems that are turned on. And over a bunch of days, that can ruin your battery, which is what happened.
And it's a little more insidious than that, even. If you have a smart start system, in other words, a push-button start, and if you have what are called smart locks or touchless locks, that you often have a key that you don't actually put in the door or in the ignition, and simply having one of those, even an extra one, just sitting in the car, they can be sensed by the car. They have sensors that'll sense that key is there, and ultimately keeps the body electric computer on in that ready and standby mode, and indeed will discharge a battery much quicker. That usually won't ruin a battery, but the difference between whether it does or doesn't ruin the battery is off and temperature related. If it's in the winter, there's a good chance that once that battery loses its charge, it's going to freeze, and then it's done.
It's toast.
And if it goes on long enough at any time of year, it's going to do that. Another related thing is that those remote controls have a watch-type battery in those as well, and most people aren't going to go through some of these finer, deeper pages in the owner's manual, but those should not be left near certain types of devices in your house either. So where you store your keys in your house can make a difference on how long that watch battery in your remote lasts, which also can be the difference between being able to get in the car or not, being able to start it or not easily. So it shouldn't be stored by a microwave, by a computer, by a cordless phone, by your cell phone. They generally recommend you keep your keys stored about a meter away from any of those kind of devices. So yeah, those concerns become a real concern when you can't start your car.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, I keep my, this key list, I keep mine in a cupboard, and that's the extra key. I don't keep it in the car. So yeah. The only thing close to it is the refrigerator. So that's not going to probably hurt anything.
Probably not.
Anne, thanks for that story. Great. Appreciate the call. And Philip in Kingston, it's your turn. Hi, Philip.
Yes, hi. Great. Thanks for a great show.
You bet.
I keep a lithium battery, one of those starter things, and what a great thing. You don't need anybody else's help. And the safety thing of not having another car and another battery, you hook it up. And I found out when people start, you have to wait for a car, another car when you're starting, like rev up or warm up and everything. And when I found out, and I hook up my lithium battery, it starts up any other car instantaneously. They also have ports for charging your phone if you need a quick charge, and also they have lights built in. You can get those for $30 or $40 on Amazon, so that's a great thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now my question is that I have a 94 Ford Tempo GL, and what it happens to do is that I notice that when I go to coast, to a stop, the car keeps on wanting to go. And then when I put it into neutral while I'm going, the engine races. So like it has a mind of its own. The engine just keeps on going and going and going. So then that's what it keeps on doing. So I heard it has something to do with some type of idling motor or idling sensor, or it almost sounds like the diabetes test, the A1C. Is it 1 something or A1 something, whatever it is, and I'm not sure. But that's what it does. It's a 94 Ford Tempo. And it's just the engine just keeps going and going. So there is no coasting.
Yeah. What the IAC is the acronym that I think you're referring to, and it's for idle air control valve. And fuel mixture on a car is controlled by controlling how much air comes in. And idle air control valves are a little mechanical device that basically pretty simple. It's got a tube within a tube that have holes in various places, kind of the way a faucet works, that it turns one way and it lets more air, and temperature controls how it turns. And those are prone to getting varnished up and sticky. They can get fuel varnishes and things in them, oil varnish from the engine, and cause them to start to stick and can make an engine idle too high. Now, there's a lot of other things that can make it idle high, and I have to be honest with you that the majority of times over the years that I've heard someone say that the car will just take off and run on its own, there was nothing wrong with the car. When the car is cold, when you start it in the wintertime, it should idle significantly faster. And under some normal circumstances, a given car, automatic transmission, you could put in gear, and with the cold, fast idle, it might go 30 to 35 miles an hour in gear without you touching the gas pedal, and that would not necessarily be abnormal under certain circumstances. It sounds like you, what you're describing is beyond the normal,
the way you're describing it there.
So
just wants to race. Race high RPMs. High, and this is even after like miles, maybe even a half hour, even an hour of driving.
And
just
so,
keeps going.
So that IEC, that idle air control valve, is certainly a culprit that could cause that. Over the years, I've seen a lot of different things cause that. I've seen cruise controls far more likely if it was like an added-on cruise control that was like an aftermarket than the factory one, where the cable got stretched and the cable can get in the wrong position and hold that throttle in a position it shouldn't be in. Various aspects of the throttles themselves can get gummed up and stick. But, there's kind of a process of elimination when you're trying to diagnose something like that. And it's, basically we start making sure that the throttle linkage is and all the mechanicals outside of it are all freed up and moving as they should. And from there, then we start looking at some of the temperature control and mixture control aspects like that idler control valve. But, there's a good possibility that's it. In most cases, those idler control valve would have to be replaced depending on the style it is. Sometimes you can clean them out. Sometimes you can take a solvent and clean the varnish out and actually get it to work right again. Sometimes you can just tap on it and get the idle to come back down. But that, and in fact, that's kind of a handy diagnostic test. You could probably Google for your particular vehicle where that valve is, and just with the engine at idle in park, just try tapping on it and see if the engine idles down. If it does, that's a pretty good indication that's where you're going to start.
All right. There we go. Thank you so much for calling. Jim Ward, our guest today, service manager at Smart Motors. He'll be with us till 12:30 today. We'll take a look at the news, then we'll be back with Jim. Great to have you with us here on the IdeasNet. Larry Mueller here, and we are visiting with vehicle maintenance expert Jim Ward. Back with us once again. Great to have him along. He's service manager at Smart Motors of Madison. He's over 10 years of master certification, worked professionally with vehicles since 1978. So he knows a lot, and I'm learning a lot. I hope you are, too. If you have a question, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. And let's turn to Bob in Claybanks next. Hi, Bob. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having the show.
Sure.
I've got a 97 Honda CR-V, and there's no fuel filter on it. And I've also got a newer Prius, and it doesn't have any fuel filter on it either. And I was wondering what kind of systems are in place with the newer cars to eliminate the need for a filter.
Well, both of those cars have fuel filters. They're just not the type of fuel filter that you're probably thinking about. They're not in line up near the engine. Used to be you'd have a little plastic, you could almost see through it, filter that you could see when they were getting dirty. And it used to be that fuel filters were something that were a maintenance item that you actually replaced at regular intervals. But the fuel filters are more of a permanent filter for the life of the car. Now they're generally located back near the fuel tank, not very far from the pump. And we just, they're designed a little bit differently so that they've got some bypass. If a little something gets in there, it isn't as likely to plug one up. The only times I really deal with any fuel filter issues in the last 10 to 15 years is in cases of fuel contamination. Every now and then a gas station will get a bad load. It was something in the truck or something, and the next six cars that come in after the truck dumps the fuel in just won't, they can't even start, hardly run away from the station depending on how much fuel they had in when they got there. And so it's a rare case. That's not a common event. Those are about the only times that we have to ever deal with fuel filters anymore.
There we go. Yeah, thanks, Bob. Appreciate the call. Vivian in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Vivian.
Hi, my apologies for earlier, but maybe you can settle a discussion regarding these icy roads, a slight incline to a driveway. Is it appropriate to downshift to drive one, two, or three to get extra traction?
It can be. It certainly can be. Inclines or hills notwithstanding, a lot of modern cars have a mode called winter mode. There's a little button you can push that, and the idea is that's going to help you get better traction leaving an icy stop. What that does in those cars is it starts the car in second gear. because then the throttle is kind of dummy down, so to speak. When you press the throttle, you're not going to get as much of that power right to the wheels, which is likely to prevent you from spinning it up. If you could, you know, if you were able to just really feather and had a really, you know, great touch with your right foot, you know, you might be able to have the same effect without having it in second gear. But, you know, either, you know, we've had some incredibly icy days this week, and on my commute, there were a couple different times coming down hills that I did put my vehicle in second gear to help the engine brake and control going down the hill to maintain control. So, you know, there are certainly some cautions about that. Once you start moving that shifter while the car is moving, this is not something that we're familiar with doing. And assuming you get it in the right place, great. And, you know, and of course, this is all presumed to be at fairly low speeds. But, you know, things can go wrong if it ends up in reverse, you know, or wrong gear. A lot of modern cars are going to be, they have intelligent transmissions that won't even allow it to go into gear. But, you know, it's something. I think if you're considering using that technique, I would recommend practicing it sometime in conditions that aren't dire icy conditions, just so that you could try it in a predictive situation that you kind of get familiar with where to move it and what to do. It's something that can work, but it's something that does require some caution.
There we go. Thank you for calling. Bob in Madison, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, thank you. I had a Ford Transit 2010. Transmission went bad at 90,000. I'm wondering, they didn't seem to think that was too unusual at the Ford place. I'm wondering if that is unusual for a transmission to go bad that fast. And then somebody suggested, I always kind of like this question that the last caller had. I downshift quite a bit. I put it into overdrive off when I'm slowing down.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody suggested maybe that was part of my problem.
You are working the transmission harder when you do that. I mean, you know, and again, the using engine braking is what that's called, and you're actually using the engine, the transmission, the whole drivetrain to brake the car, to slow the car, to control the car. And in certain circumstances, like, as I said, I did that earlier. I live in a really steep hill, and mm-hmm. Monday and Tuesday this week were really interesting. It was kind of like going sledding rather than driving a vehicle. And so using low in a situation like that where you don't necessarily want a lot of brake action because that can lead to some instability, is kind of a rare circumstance. I think it's the first time I've ever done it in this particular vehicle, and I probably haven't done that prior in 10 years. So I wouldn't make a regular habit of downshifting a vehicle because your brakes are cheap. Brakes are relatively inexpensive. They can be replaced. Transmissions or other drivetrain components are not. The conventional wisdom is, though, theoretically, you can do that now and then, and it's not going to hurt anything, but to make a regular practice of it is probably working some systems in ways that vehicles were more designed to handle 20 years ago, 30 years ago than they are now.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you, Bob. Appreciate the call. Dan in Westby, it's your turn. Hi, Dan.
Yes, hello. I had a simple question. Was wondering about mixing ethanol fuel with premium fuel. Good idea or bad idea?
I don't really see a point in doing it.
Well, for the moisture displacement, yeah. I guess.
It sounds like you probably prefer to run the premium fuel with the higher octane, but you know, and back before we used ethanol, we talked about heat. You know, if you had one type of fuel system, the fuel injection, you use the red heat. If you had a other type of carburetor, you use the yellow heat. And ultimately now with ethanol and the fuel, we don't need to do that at all. There are a lot of different opinions about ethanol but really, I see fewer problems in cars rather than more problems in cars with the advent of ethanol. You know, it gets complicated when you start talking about E85, but the normal 10% that we have in it, depending on the car you're driving, again, fuel systems are really dialed in. And if the manufacturer of your vehicle says that vehicle should run fine on 87 octane fuel, on most modern vehicles, you're not really gaining much of anything by putting premium in it. There was a time that, you know, if you weren't paying too much more for the premium, that the increased performance and fuel mileage even would be enough to even pay for it. But that is not so true on modern vehicles, no.
There we go. All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Travis on Facebook has a question. He says, a question about his Ford Explorer Sport Track. It's a 2005 that he got about a year ago. He's jumped cars for friends and families once in a while. And his instrument cluster is all crazy. Gauges all over, LCD screen flickering. Is this just common in these vehicles or from jumping the vehicles?
Well, it certainly could happen. I can't say I'm intimately familiar enough with an 05 Ford Explorer Sport to tell you if that is a characteristic. Larry and I were talking earlier, and there are certain characteristic damages that will occur to certain vehicles if they're jump-started wrong, if something goes wrong, or if a voltage spike occurs. There are certain models that we see that it's going to be the blower motor every time. Other models will be a radio. I can't say that an 05 Explorer, that the instrument panel is something I am familiar enough with to know that that's a pattern. You could probably just about Google it and see if it was, because there'd be a pattern there. But, you know, the key is to whether a jump start started it. It's difficult to say because as we talk about this, this is something that most of the time the damage that's going to occur is going to occur immediately and be obvious. But that's not always the case. We've seen instances where actually a part of the body electric computer was affected by a jump start, and what ultimately eventually was noticed, because it was in cold weather, so it wasn't, but many, many weeks, maybe a couple months later, the first time they went to open the power windows, and the power windows didn't work, and it was found that circuit was burned out in the body electric computer, very likely related to that jump start incident, where a couple of other fuses had to be replaced, but it wasn't known that there was other damage. So, you know, normally I would say, well, if it happened right after you jump started it, then you can conclude that it was a jump start. And if it didn't, then you can probably conclude it wasn't. But that's not necessarily the case, because you can have damage a little bit of damage that occurs that can actually change over time and get worse. So I really can't answer your question definitively whether that was damaged by the jump start, but there is a risk. There is a risk. I mean, there are people anymore who have been through a damaged vehicle from being the donor vehicle or having jump started who will basically decline to help you if you need a jump start because they've had that experience. So it is It is possible, and that's why you want to do this the safest that you can when you're jump starting.
John in Madison has a question. Hi, John.
Guest Jim, I had a question about a hybrid.
Okay.
I have a Camry hybrid, and in the last month or so, after some service work done, my fuel consumption is going up. In other words, my hybrid battery is not cutting in when it normally would, like when I come to a stop.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and I think we're going to find that's temperature related. If you don't use your heater and your defroster, you're less likely to have that come on. But I'm not going to recommend doing that just to get that gas mileage. All vehicles get poorer fuel mileage when it's cold out, and hybrids in particular. When you're using a rear defroster and you're using the heat and you're using the blower motor, using a lot more electrical power, and that gas engine's got to run to maintain that battery. And that battery, and whether we're talking about the hybrid battery or the 12-volt battery, either one of them is more challenged in the cold. The 12-volt battery is not necessarily going to give a warning, but it is not likely to be related to this. But your 12-volt battery can be tested to tell if it's got life and if it's okay. The hybrid battery is the one in question here, and if the hybrid battery has a problem, it's a self-monitored, self-diagnostic system. You'll have a warning light come on. You can have a code in that system telling us that there's something in that battery, and that hybrid system monitors that battery to an incredible degree beyond what most vehicle diagnostics are. So, if it's not giving you any kind of warning, it's just the cold weather and the fact that you're using heat and you're using more electrical power than you normally have, and the engine has to run more to keep that battery charged.
There we go. All right. Thanks, John. Kathy in Marshfield, your turn. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I purchased a new 2016 Tahoe in July, and I took it in December for its first routine service. And prior to that, I got a maximum mileage of up to 26 miles per gallon with an average of 19.9. And after the service, it dropped to 15 with a maximum of like 15.5. And when I asked them about it, they said, well, it's because of the winter mix of the gasoline. that seems like an awful big drop of 5 miles per gallon just because it would be winter gasoline.
The winter mix of gas does make a difference, but it's the cold weather also makes a difference. How far is your commute?
Well, it's about 10 miles.
And that's a decent range. The longer the commute, the more the car is going to warm up and the better the mileage will be. In a situation like this, ultimately whether there's so many variables, whether you do or do not warm up your car makes a difference, because if you warm up your car, every moment it sits there, it's actually taking away from the mileage you're going to get once you start driving, because it's still using fuel. It's also dependent on how you drive. We tend to use more devices, again, like the heat, even though we're not talking about a hybrid. The more of those things that you use, the more load there is on the engine. Even though you're driving the same place and the same speed, you're taxing the electrical system, which then requires the engine to work harder to keep up with all that. That's a factor as well. What I would do in this situation, that you can go to a website called fueleconomy.gov, and on fueleconomy.gov, there's a place where you can look up your year and model vehicle, and you can look for, you can post your mileage, and it'll ask you what your city mileage and your highway mileage is, and you can see postings from other people with the same car. It tells where they live, and it'll ask you what your percentage of highway and city driving is. So you go to look for people that live in a similar climate as you, that have a similar mix of city and highway driving, and see if that's what other people are getting. If everybody's reporting about the same as what you're getting in the similar climate and circumstances, that's what you're going to get.
That's what you're going to get. There you go. Thank you for calling. Larry emailed us to say that manuals state that the ground cable should be connected to the chassis when you're jumping a car, but I can't find a metal part of the chassis in my Toyota. Is there any problem connecting the ground cable to the negative terminal?
There's no problem until there is. It is never recommended to put that last battery cable on the terminal. That being said, people do it, I would bet, every day in the state of Wisconsin for the last 2 weeks that has occurred. Someone has put it direct battery to battery. But that is not how you should do it. You should look for a bare metal surface that's not painted. The top of your suspension in the front has got bolts there that are not painted. Your alternator bracket over on the engine, but I got to be a little careful there because there's belts right below there. That bracket is metal and is not painted. You may not, I'm trying to think how easy this access, where the ground cable, you'd be better off following that ground cable to where it goes down to the frame down below the battery and at least getting it that far away, because connecting that is where you can get a spark to occur and any, there's enough power there literally to start yourself on fire, to start the car on fire, to ignite fumes around it. There's a lot of safety reasons why that's just not recommended to be done.
Lewis in Milwaukee, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I just had a question. I have a 2007 Impala, and I was wondering, sometimes when I'm driving and I put my brakes, sometimes the car decides to accelerate itself. And also another thing, when I'm, like, let's say I come to a stop, I press the accelerator, sometimes it stalls and it won't go forward. It takes time for it to go forward. Can you tell me, like, what it is?
When you say you step on the accelerator and it stalls, usually when I say that, I mean that the car shuts off and I have to turn the key and restart it. But I'm getting the feeling that's not what you're talking about. Do you just mean it hesitates or it actually shuts off?
Yeah, it hesitates.
It hesitates. So that kind of hesitation can come from different sources. It could be related to something with the engine fuel controls, but it could be low transmission fluid can do that. If your transmission fluid level is low enough, it just may have to generate pressure before it can move. It takes... There are a number of different things that really can cause those symptoms from different systems in the car. It's really going to take some testing to narrow it down and find out what is causing that on your car.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks for calling. Bob and Franklin, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I have a new Subaru Outback, and I recently did the first oil change, and unfortunately I overfilled it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Should I be panicky about this, or can I just let it go until the next oil change?
How much is a little bit?
Well, it was at the low level mark, and I the manual said I could add a quart if it was at the low level,
mm-hmm.
but now it's above the high level mark.
On most cars, the distance between the marks represents a quart.
Yeah, this went over a quart.
And most modern cars are engineered and designed, and I hesitate to say this, but it is true, to run perfectly fine, a quart low or a quart over full. There is a point, and I've had cars come in that were double filled.
Oh.
They were double filled. They had twice as much oil put in as they should have. And although oil was getting into the intake and being burned, there was no permanent damage done in that situation. Not being able to see your car, I hesitate to say it's okay, but it's probably going to be just fine. If the distance it is above the full mark is the same or less than the distance from the low to the full mark, I don't think you have a problem. I don't think you have anything to worry about at all.
Well, when I do another car, I'll just try to drain a little bit out.
there you go.
You can do that. Yep. I have a feeling you're going to sleep better if you correct the level, but I don't think it's going to hurt anything.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Dave in Stockton, your turn. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Jim, my question, a couple callers ago addressed one of mine, so it might be some repeating. But in terms of charging a battery, I was growing up where the negative cable was supposed to be on a negative terminal of the battery, but I heard in the past and what you said today, that's not right. The problem is trying to find a metal piece in my car, sometimes the problem, well, I have a couple of cars. Now, I do warn people, don't put it in a gas line, because I read that you don't put it by the gas line. But my cables are only so long. Would the sheet metal, if I don't have an unpainted bolt that I can reach, is like a sheet metal of the car, would that work?
It may work. I wouldn't recommend it, though. I mean, sheet metal generally is painted, and most people spend a lot of time trying to avoid having something like a sharp, jagged edge clamped onto that sheet metal and onto that paint. And again, a voltage spike, you can end up with a burn mark. So if you're on a painted surface, so it's possible that it might actually conduct electricity and work, but it wouldn't be a preferred place.
No, it wouldn't be painted. I understand that.
Yeah.
It would be unpainted.
Right. I mean, again, the preferred place is to try to get to something heavier than that.
Like you said.
Right.
Okay. Yep. One more thing I keep forgetting, and I probably have written down in the car someplace. Do you put the negative, what's the sequence? The negative on
the sequence?
First. I think it's a positive on.
You put the positive on the dead battery car first, and then you put the other positive on the donor battery on the positive side, then you put the negative on the donor battery, and at that point, that other third negative cable is live. So at that point, you want to be very careful where that goes, what you touch it to. You want to make sure you're holding onto the handles and that the actual metal contacts down on the end of that clamp don't get near your skin or near you or near, you don't want to wave them over the battery or move them around. You don't want to touch them to other metal surfaces. So you want to have a plan before you get to this point. You want to know where you're going to be putting that. You don't want to be waving that around thinking, oh, should I go here? Should I go there? So don't even start putting these cables on until you've determined where that last cable is going to go and you've got that all figured out. But the order is positive to the dead battery, positive to the donor battery, positive terminal, negative on the donor, and lastly, the fourth one, the negative for the car with the dead battery goes onto a good ground position somewhere away from the battery.
Good place to wind up, Jim. Thank you so much. You're coming back April 20th, I've got.
Fantastic. It'll be much warmer.
It'll be much warmer. Thanks again for being with us. Jim Ward is service manager at Smart Motors. He knows a lot, doesn't he? Over 10 years master certification and worked professionally with vehicles since 1978. Well, thank you for listening, and I hope you'll please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.